The decision from the federal judge in Texas was sweeping, but it has little immediate impact because the Affordable Care Act remains in place while the legal fight continues, possibly to the Supreme Court. We're looking at what's going on with the ACA here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're asking, what will this federal judge's decision mean for Obamacare, and what do Wisconsinites have to say? Healthcare was the top issue for about a quarter of voters in the November election. It was ahead of immigration and jobs and the economy. That's according to VoteCast. That's a nationwide survey for the Associated Press. Let's go to Charlie Jacobs now, who's keeping an eye on all of this. He's an associate professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere, and his areas of expertise include American politics and the judicial process. Charlie, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
So this Republican-appointed federal judge in Texas rules the Affordable Care Act unconstitutional. What did the judge do exactly, and is it binding?
Well, it's binding as far as we know. There is, I think, some confusion on the part of the defendants in this case about exactly what's going to transpire going forward, because on Friday, it was such a late response from the court that I think, in particular, the Attorney General from the state of California wondered, what are we doing? Because it doesn't appear that Judge O'Connor offered an injunction which would have stopped further implementation or of the ACA. But what does seem like is going to happen is he's going to put a stay on his ruling, which will mean that until appeals are filed and we get a final word from another court, the Affordable Care Act will continue to operate. Now, what he said is a little bit complicated, so I'm going to sort of walk through it slowly so I make sure I understand it as well. Originally, when this act was challenged in court, it was on a number of different constitutional threads. And it was upheld because the court, Justice Roberts in particular, said Congress has the authority to pass this sweeping health care legislation because they have the power to tax. Mm-hmm. And because we can tax, it means that we can mandate individuals have health care, and if they don't, they have to pay a tax, which they called a shared responsibility payment, in order to sustain the system. Because if you have people not having health care, then it's going to be really hard to financially sustain the program.
Well, part of the tax overhaul that the president signed a year ago, Congress reduced the penalty to $0 in 2019 for not having health insurance. How does that play into this?
Well, that's the hook here. And so there's this litigation that's pending and that Judge O'Connor just ruled on. It came from 20 different states. The attorney generals from 20 different states, Republicans. And they were arguing that because they zeroed out the tax, then in essence that wipes out the individual mandate, because now you're not mandated to have health care coverage at all. Well, they speculated, if you don't need to have health care, then the entire bill just collapses like a house of cards. And that's exactly what the judge ruled. Because they zeroed out the tax, the individual mandate is null and void, then the entire ACA is gone, which would mean that all of the aspects of it, support for additional Medicaid and the underinsured, protections for individuals with pre-existing conditions, those would all be gone. And in essence, you'd have to start from scratch to create a new health care bill, much of which the public at this point supports.
Well, then we arrive at yesterday, when California and 15 other states asked a federal judge to protect coverage of people and to affirm the ACA is still law. They said Friday's ruling created ambiguity, and they asked the judge to clarify whether what he meant for his decision to have an immediate legal effect. So what is going on there, and what are these states trying to do?
Well, the states are just trying to prop it up until they can appeal, because the worry is if the judge issues an injunction and stops the application of this law, the healthcare marketplace is just going to go into chaos, because no one is going to exactly know what the government is going to cover, if anything at all, because most of the payments to healthcare companies that cover some of these costs, they'll all disappear. And so what California and other states that are trying to defend this are asking the judge is, could you tell us by Friday so that we have some certainty and that we can move forward with our appeals that are pending. I mean, there are going to be appeals to this case.
Charlie, are states almost weaponizing the ACA and using it to attack, it seems, other states that support the law?
I'm not sure if they're attacking other states. Uh-huh. They just so loathe this piece of legislation and the legacy that Obama has related to this, that they're trying, and in essence, grasping at straws, trying to find ways to either undermine it or eradicate it completely. Of course, they're creating some problems for themselves and others in doing so, but there is certainly an us versus them, a Democratic attorney generals and states versus Republicans, but I'm not sure if that's sort of the way the battle lines have been drawn. It's more Republicans and conservatives who still want to try and eliminate this particular piece of legislation.
We're talking with St. Norbert College political scientist Charlie Jacobs, who's talking us through the new legal challenge to the ACA and what it means going forward. Gathering your thoughts as well at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the healthcare ruling? And if you're insured under the ACA, what are your concerns? What actions would you like lawmakers to take regarding pre-existing conditions? Join in at 800-642-1234. Charlie, going back to this lawsuit that was brought by Texas and 19 other states, including Wisconsin and outgoing Attorney General Brad Schimmel, how does this ruling impact the lawsuit going forward?
So what I think we're going to see is come Friday when we hear more from Judge Reed O'Connor down in Texas, there'll be an appeal filed with the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which covers Texas, where this decision came from, and they'll proceed with arguments trying to dispute what the judge ruled. And it's a technical legal matter about statutory construction, but what it has to do with is whether or not one element of a bill fails, is unconstitutional, does the rest remain? It's called severability. In essence, can you cut one part of the bill out or the legislation out and retain the rest? And what Judge O'Connor said was no, if one element fails, the argument here is the entire thing collapses, so we're going to toss the whole thing out. This seems to fly in the face of most established precedent on this issue, and so it's kind of a unique and some would argue far-fetched argument, but nonetheless, it's one that's going to have to be challenged on appeal, and that's going to be the central argument that California and other states bring to the appellate court on appeal.
Let's bring in Steve now in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. The original Obamacare was passed pretty much by all Democrats and now being torn down by all Republicans. Just wondering what the guest thoughts are on having a bipartisan commission that would really overhaul our health care in a way that might be supported by both parties. For example, Paul Ryan had a refundable tax credit plan back when he was running as VP. Wondering, you know, that could be something that's a win-win for both parties. But don't know about the appetite with the whole resist movement going on.
Steve, thanks. Charlie Jacobs, your thoughts there.
I mean, certainly I think that's the hope. Both Republicans and Democrats, I think, have recognized there are benefits to the program. I think a lot of Republicans would admit that there are some things that they would like to retain. Democrats recognize that they really made some errors when they created this. So some sort of conciliatory gesture by both sides might be very effective, but the problem is, in this environment right now, I think it's unlikely. Certainly, President Trump has indicated he wants a different bill, but whether or not what he wants is going to comport with whatever the two parties come up with is really hard to see.
We're looking at what happens next to the ACA after a federal judge in Texas ruled it unconstitutional. We're with St. Norbert College political scientist Charlie Jacobs. And when we come back, will there be a partial government shutdown on Friday? What are your thoughts on a $5 billion request for border security? 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Let's look at the shutdown. What's at stake? Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. By a double-digit margin, Americans oppose a government shutdown over the border wall. And by nearly 2-1, Americans would blame President Trump and the Republicans opposed to congressional Democrats. That's from a new USA Today Suffolk University poll. Charlie Jacobs stays with us. He's an associate professor of political science at St. Norbert College. Your questions, your insights on a partial government shutdown possibility, 800-642-1234. This week's looming government shutdown is primarily over the issue of funding a border wall. What do you think needs to be done about immigration? Is there another federal funding model you'd like to see in place? You can call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Charlie, we're facing this potential partial government shutdown once again. How did we get to this point? That's a big question, but how did we arrive at this?
Republicans and Democrats don't get along. I suppose that's the easiest answer. It's because we have had a faulty, broken budget process for about 40 years in American politics. The whole process involves passing 12 appropriation bills that cover all of government operation. And what's supposed to happen is the House and Senate come up with appropriation bills sometime in April, and they try to pass them by October 1st, which is the start of the fiscal year. It's only happened 4 times in the last 40 years. Last time was in 1997. And what happens is infighting about exactly what should be funded and what shouldn't stalls some of these bills. And as a result, they have to pass what are called CRs, or continuing resolutions, to try to keep the doors open. This year, we haven't done it again. And it's basically over the border wall that President Trump promised during the campaign, in which he continues to try to effectuate, and Democrats just are resistant to it. So that one issue is basically holding up about 25% of our discretionary spending and will likely shut down the government if we don't have a CR by Friday.
So a week ago, we saw this televised meeting, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, very tense with the president. And the president insisted he had the support in the House for a border wall funding. Pelosi said he didn't have the votes. Will lawmakers reach a consensus by the Friday deadline?
I doubt it for a couple of reasons. Well, we may get to a CR, but I don't think we're going to get to anything that's really substantive about border security. I think that what they're going to probably pass is something that just keeps us operating through the start of the new Congress in January. But I think that there's too much tension over exactly how any additional money should be spent at the border, whether it's for a wall or some other barrier or for additional sort of technological changes that will help us better manage the border security. One of the problems is that a lot of Republicans and some Democrats who are not returning to Congress have just gone home. They no longer want to engage in this. And so some who might have voted for the border wall aren't in D.C. and don't plan on returning. The House isn't even going to be in session until tomorrow. So there is a very small window to try to crawl through and get this thing done before we shut down on Saturday morning.
So in that same meeting, the president said he'd be proud to shut down the government over the issue of border security. What about that strategy on taking the blame?
Well, he may be proud, but I think the polls are going to indicate otherwise if the government shuts down. No one is going to come out unscathed. They never do from these kinds of things. So there will be blame heaped on both parties. But he's been so aggressive in wanting a shutdown that it is very likely, and I think early polls are already indicating, people are going to aim a blame directly at President Trump, and then likely Republicans who aren't able to talk him towards the middle and get some sort of resolution on this problem.
And what I've looked at numbers here, roughly 800,000 federal workers would be furloughed or forced to work without pay if there isn't a signing by before midnight on Friday. What does this proposed partial government shutdown look compared to ones in the past?
You know, they all have their their own unique characteristics. I think what's unique about this one is it's right around the holidays, which means we're going to have a lot of people who are working and not drawing paychecks. We're going to have some people just sitting home at furloughs wondering whether or not they would get paid once they return to office. And I think for a lot of people, they're not going to notice a lot changing. Social Security checks show up. You're going to get through TSA because they're working. So those kinds of things will go on. without any kind of budget resolution or continuing resolution here. But I think what we see here is that there's such an unwillingness to compromise. That's what's making this so different. They have dug in their heels so deeply on both sides that I don't think we're going to have something until we swear in the new Congress sometime in January.
Well, $1.5 billion or so the Democrats are willing to give, $5 billion the President Trump wants. Most Republicans are saying that, too. So, you know, how do you get from $1.5 billion to $5 billion? That's a big difference.
It is, and I think the problem is that the strategies that they're thinking about for the border are so different that it's hard to come to some sort of compromise. You can't build sort of part of a wall because that's sort of useless. The techniques that the Democrats are offering are things like more drones, more technology, more assets that are softer rather than a barrier that is being promoted. So it's very difficult for the Republicans like President Trump who want a border wall to move off of that, because any alternative is not a border wall. And for Democrats, if they accede to any kind of barrier, they have to go all in. So it's going to be difficult to negotiate the middle ground here because there isn't really a middle ground.
Charlie Jacobs is a political scientist at St. Norbert College. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support a partial government shutdown over border security? What should be done to remedy this impasse between Democrats and Republicans? And do you work for an agency that will be impacted by a potential partial shutdown? 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Charlie, what have Wisconsin's members of Congress said about this? Are they in line with their parties?
Well, it's very predictable. Ron Johnson in particular has been with the president, and in part that's because he's chair of Homeland Security Committee in the Senate. So it's his job to try and marshal the support for presidential priorities for his party. So it doesn't seem as though that's surprising. And unsurprising as well is that Tammy Baldwin in the Senate has said she's perfectly willing to sign on for the $1.5 billion for the improvements, but she does not want to see the wall go up. And you know, sort of lost in all of this is the president's promise during the campaign that Mexico would pay for the border wall, but that sort of idea has evaporated over time, and no one's really discussing where this money is coming from in sort of lean budget times at the moment.
It seems like government shutdowns or the potential for one have been a common occurrence, but can you put this in context for us? Is this unusual?
Not really. We've been doing this kind of budget process, again, for about the last 40 years or so. During that time, we've had over 175 continuing resolutions to keep us going because we couldn't agree on these appropriation bills. We've had 19 shutdowns in 20 years, some of them very short, but some of them longer and, you know, really drawing the ire of the public because we can't get this done. So it's been a problem, and Congress has been talking about trying to change the budget process as best they can, because what they passed several years ago and they've been using for more than a half century just hasn't been working very well.
So as you look at this one, what parts of the federal government would go unfunded?
Lots. So there are only five of the 12 appropriation bills that have passed, and there's some of them are big, and that's why a lot of the government is going to still operate. So defense, labor, Health and Human Services, those have all passed, as well as legislative branch appropriations, energy and water. But things like the Justice Department, the State Department, Interior, Agriculture, NASA, the EPA, Small Business Administration, a bunch of large and small agencies alike are not going to get funded. Now, one thing to keep in mind is essential employees are going to have to show up and work anyway. So they're going to be there, and that's why you don't really notice it. They're just working without pay. And hopefully Congress, when they do pass appropriations bills, will pay them back, and they typically do, but not always.
Can history help us in any way in finding a resolution to this particular impasse?
I'm not sure history is much of a guide, because so many of these are bound up in very narrow partisan issues that are driven by that moment, by that day. whether it's about healthcare issues or whether it's about this border wall. Sometimes there are larger systemic issues, but for the most part, it's about something that is being driven by the political discourse of that moment. And so I think this is just, every one of them is sort of unique. And so I think more than anything, the budget process itself has to be evaluated so that we have some sort of fail-safe that these kinds of things don't happen as frequently as they have been doing right now.
And Charlie, what do you have your eye on here as we watch what's going on?
I think what I have my eye on is whether or not Republicans sort of look backwards a few weeks at the midterm election and wonder what kind of ramification this will have going forward as we head into the presidential election cycle. And are they willing to rebuke their president and be a little conciliatory so that they can move forward and then take credit for that as they run for re-election in 2020?
Charlie Jacobs, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Charlie Jacobs is an associate professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Areas of expertise include American politics and judicial process. Up next, it's news. Then at a time when some colleges and universities are reconsidering their humanities offerings, UW Green Bay is launching a new writing degree. We'll take a look at it. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.